Sure, that would be great. Thanks.
Good morning. As usual, I just want to thank Yeshiva University's Midrashat Yom Rishon for having me again. This is always a pleasure. What I thought we'd do today is what I think is a fun exercise. Hopefully you'll think this is fun too, in intertextuality. So intertextuality is just a modern, fancy way of saying anytime you use one text to look at another text, anytime you compare two texts, or more specifically, when you use one text to better or more fully understand another text that you're looking at, so that at the end of the day, there's a more complex relationship that exists between those texts than you would have thought at the beginning. So I thought what we would do today is the following. I'm going to run through three different basic ways that we use intertextuality in Tanakh and that Chazal themselves used when they looked at totally different texts in Tanakh, some that seem more similar, some that you wouldn't think are similar at all until you look at them. We'll go through those three ways, we'll give some examples, and then I want to take a little bit of a twist on the classic theme or the classic derech of intertextuality and look at Rut and Esther from an intertextual perspective in a little bit of a different way than the three classic modes of looking at it. So let's get started. Three classic ways to kind of use or do intertextuality are through similar themes or motifs, through similar phrases or aphorisms that appear in texts, and finally through the use of a rare word that appears in two different texts in Tanakh. So let me go through some kind of more classic examples of each of these. Similar themes or motifs. So everyone in this room has learned about intertextuality or done it, even if you don't even realize. Let's say a classic example from Megillat Esther in a similar theme of intertextuality would be looking at Esther in comparison to Daniel or Yosef, who are often compared, not only in Chazal, but in general. They're looked at together. Here you have an example of two people who rise to power in a foreign court, use their influence to help out not only their own people, but in lots of other ways as well. And Esther is often looked at as a mirror image to Yosef for the idea of the success of a Jew in exile. So that's kind of motif. I've always liked the way Robert Alter, who's kind of a classic, who has taken this theme of intertextuality and motifs to a certain, to a certain specific way, the way he describes it. He's a professor of comparative literature at UCLA, and he wrote a very well-known book called The Art of Biblical Narrative, in which he develops this idea called a type story. So for those of you who haven't, I've ever heard of Robert Alter, this chapter in his book on the type story is truly worth reading. It's really fascinating. And what he does is he looks at different stories or themes that seem to appear very often or repeat themselves in Tanakh. So for instance, the idea of the barren woman, the birth of a leader or a hero to the barren woman, the epiphany field. He looks at themes that repeat themselves. One of his most famous ones, which he discusses in his book, is the type story of meeting one's future wife or one's betrothed at a well. And he talks about how that appears often many times. You have Yitzchak or his representative of Eliezer, you have Yaakov meeting his wife, Moshe meeting his wife, and he goes through the themes that appear very often, compares them, looks at the way they compare, but also the way they contrast, and he has just a beautiful paragraph that I think speaks to this idea of comparing themes or motifs in stories, which is source one on your sheet, and he calls it the type scene or the type story. He says, the type scene is not merely a way of formally recognizing a particular kind of narrative moment, meaning this is not just a literary exercise. Yay, we found lots of similarities that repeat themselves. But it is also a means of attaching that moment to a larger pattern of historical and theological meaning. If Yitzchak and Rivka, as the first man and wife actually born into the breed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has made with Avram, provides certain paradigmatic traits for the future historical destiny of Israel, any association of later figures with that specific juncture, that critical juncture, crucial juncture of that first story, therefore implies some connection of meaning. I love the way he phrases it. I think this is something we all do naturally. You compare two stories and you try to pull some meaning from it, but I just kind of like the way he presents it, that once you have that first story, you can use it to provide meaning for later stories. So I don't want to look at that specific meeting at the well type story. It's not the the goal of our lesson today, but that's a little bit what we're going to do, and I think that's what happens when you look at this idea of the theme type story. Anytime Chazal make a statement like Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro, or let's look at Avraham and his generation versus Noach and his generation, so that's really what they began, that thousands of years later we can talk about in fancy language, but they started this idea of let's look at two different ideas or two different themes that might appear in different stories and compare them. So that's kind of the exercise in intertextuality when you just kind of look at different themes, ideas that repeat themselves. That's one. This doesn't really rely on similar language or similar language stems. It's just ideas that repeat themselves. The second way of looking or way of doing kind of intertextual exercise is by looking at phrases or aphorisms that are similar. So a very well-known one from Megillat Esther that appears in Chazal is here in source number 3. If you take a look, there is a pretty well-known Midrash Rabbah that says, source number 3 here, Breishit, Parshas Hamas Zayin Pesach Dalid, Kishmoa Esav et Divrei Aviv. So it makes this connection between two stories that when Esav, when he heard that he had lost the bracha to Yaakov, that his brother had stolen the bracha from him, Vayizak Da'aka, Gilola Amara, that he had a very strong, bitter, angry cry. Hecha Nifralo, says the Midrash, at what point was Yaakov punished for this? Or at one point did Yaakov kind of receive payback for inflicting this type of pain on his brother, even if what he did was justified and necessary? B'shushan Habira, this is when generations later this kind of came back at Yaakov. Shene Emar v'yizak zaka gudola mara ad me'od, when the Jews heard about the gzeirah from Haman, about what would happen to them, it uses very similar language, almost exactly the same. Therefore, Chazal say, let's draw a connection between these two stories and say, just like the ancestor of Haman, Amalek Esav, received a certain degree of tsar from the hands of Yaakov. Later on, this is what happened. We can draw a connection between these two stories based on the phraseology. So this happens kind of all over Tanakh. It can be, you know, every single one of them is a shiur in and of itself in terms of what we can learn or what we can take from it. I actually saw a piece, an article written by Rav Yonatan Grossman who teaches at the Gush and Migdal Oz and Bar Ilan University, in where he made a very interesting connection that I just want to show you as an example, because it's a really great one. Again, not the goal of today, but I think it highlights this type of use of phraseology when we read two different units in Tanakh. So if you take a look at sources number 2, one from Megillat Esther and one from Sefer Melachim Aleph, he draws an interesting connection between the story of Esther and the story of Ahab and Izebel and Kerem Navod. So just as a brief intro, for anyone not familiar with that story, we have Ahab and Izebel, the lovely couple, not the most well-known for their righteousness in Tanakh, a particular story at the end of Melachim Aleph, with the story of Kerem Navot, the vineyard of Navot, where Ahab walks out one day, there's a man named Navot who has a vineyard that's adjacent to the palace. Ahab decides he wants this piece of land, offers to buy it from Navot. Navot does not want to sell it. It's part of his ancestral nachala. Ahab comes back really upset, really depressed. Izebel says, listen, I can totally help you out with this. You're the king. You know, leave this to me. I'll make it happen. And interestingly enough, Rav Grossman points out, with a little bit of a twist on this idea of language and intertextuality, that if you look at the words that are used in the way Izebel takes care of the situation, it's very similar, actually, to the way Haman kind of takes control of Ahasuerus's power over his Medina when he decides that he has something he wants to do in terms of the country. So take a look in sources, the source set in the box is number 2. So take a look first from the psukim from Megillat Esther and Perek Gimel. Vayikaru Sifrei HaMelech b'chodesh ha'shom b'shlosha asar yom bo, vayikatev k'chol asher tziva haman el achashtar p'nei ha'melech el ha'pachot asher al medina u'medina ve'el sarei am v'am. So this is a situation where they decided, Haman's convinced the king that he can use his name and his signature to send out this gzeirah on the Jews, and they send this out to each am, kilshono, b'shem ha'melech achashveirosh nechtav. They write it in the name of Ahasuerus, v'nechtam b'tabat ha'melech, seal it with the ring of the king, v'nishloach sfarim b'yad ha'ratzim, they send out these edicts, they wrote these scrolls, to all the Medinot HaMelech, La'shmid, La'harog, La'abed, Kol Yehudim, Minar, Va'adzakein, to destroy all the Jews on the specific date set. Then Rav Grossman says, well, take a look at the way it's described, the way Izebel takes control of the situation from Achav. V'atashov Sarim b'shem Achav, she writes Sarim in the name of Achav, v'atachtom b'chotamo, and she signs it with his signature, and she sends out the Sfarim to the people she needs to do her bidding for what she is going to do to Navot. So you kind of have these echoes of these very similar writings. Somebody who is writing out a letter in the name of the person who's really in charge. The person who's really in charge doesn't really know what's going on, but their underling is kind of taking over in a way where they're using the power of the person over them to do what it is they want to do. So Haman is kind of being compared in some ways to Izebel. What's the point of this analogy, says Rav Grossman? And he actually has a beautiful piece in which he says that, you know, what's going on here is really kind of making a judgment about Achav and Achashverosh together. Achav, we know, is considered later by Eliyahu HaNavi to be found extremely guilty for the death of Navot. Izebel sets up a fictitious trial in which Navot is found guilty and killed so that Achav can have his vineyard. And later on, Eliyahu HaNavi comes to Achav and basically tells him, what you've done here is terrible, even if you didn't, quote unquote, know about it. And there's a comparison here being made between Achashverosh and Achav, who are the two kind of men in power in this situation, in which perhaps Achashverosh is being faulted for allowing this to happen with his name and his signature and his seal, even if this wasn't necessarily something that was his idea or that he did. So again, you can kind of make that judgment call by comparing the two characters. Rav Grossman goes on to develop an idea called dynamic analogy, which is really fascinating. Again, I wish I could give a two-hour lecture on this, but he says that if you watch throughout Esther, different people get compared to different people in the Achav and Izebel story. So in the example that I gave you, Haman compared to Izebel, and Achashverosh is being compared to Achav. But he says if you find another point of intertextuality in the Esther story, it's when Haman comes back and is very upset about the fact that Mordechai is being honored, and I'm going to run through this quickly because it's not the goal, it's just really interesting, I can't skip over it. And you have the story where Zeresh, his wife, comes to him and says, why are you so upset? He tells her, she says, oh please, I have this great idea, go to the king, you'll see, it's going to be totally fine, and Haman is happy again. Well, a very similar story happens with Achav and Izebel. He comes back, he's sar v'zaif that he can't get this vineyard. His wife says, tell me what's wrong. And he tells her, and she says, that's nothing to be worried about. Don't worry, I'll take care of it. And then Achav is happy again. So again, that kind of similar story. But this time, right, this time Haman is actually being compared to Achav. Before, Haman was being compared to Izebel in the story. In the twist on this story, Haman is being compared to Achav. And Rav Grossman develops this wonderful idea of dynamic analogy, where analogies kind of shift like that throughout the story. And he talks about what we can learn about that. The conclusion he comes to kind of make a very long story short, is that what's happening here is, again, Achav, we're making a statement about Achav, in that at some point he's compared to Achverosh, but at some point he's compared to Haman, to kind of ask this question of what is evil when it comes to Achashverosh and Haman. Achashverosh seems to not be evil so much in the text. It's really Haman who's the evil person in the text. And yet, if we look at the comparison, how they're both compared to Achav, we often look at the story of Achav as someone who, again, even though he didn't really know what was going on, he's very much faulted, and this might be a fault on Achashverosh. By comparing both of them, by comparing Achav to both of them, you can come up with conclusions about what their characters are like. Is Achashverosh more like Haman than we tend to think when we read through the story? How much fault do we give the person in charge? And you can really develop a lot of these kind of conversations by comparing them to that story. So again, it's a really beautiful piece that he did. He called it dynamic analogy. So that's our second category, phrases that have comparisons to each other in different stories. So we have our idea of themes that seem to echo each other, phrases that echo each other, and finally, rare words that echo each other. So I think a great example from this, again, take it from Megillat Esther, is if you look at the source set number 4, Megillat Esther, we find in Perek Vav Pasuk Vav, Vayivez Be'enav L'shloach Yad B'Mordechai Levado Ki Gidu Lo Ata'am Vayar Haman Ki Ein Mordechai Korea Mishtachavel Vayimalei Haman Chema Lashmid Et Kol HaYehudim. So Vayivez Be'enav is a way of the word Vayivez is a word that only appears twice in Tanakh. The second one we're going to look at in a moment appears in Sefer Bereishit, which means kind of filled with hatred or scorn, really strong resentment. That is the strong resentment that Haman really felt towards Mordechai, both when he wouldn't bow to him, when he had to lead him through the streets, this kind of strong resentment. That word only appears one other time in Tanakh, and Sefer Bereishit, Parak Chapeh, once again, when again with Esav and Yaakov, when Esav sells the bechora to Yaakov for a nezida dashim, for the lentil stew. V'Yaakov natan le'Esav lechem u'nezida dashim, v'yocha v'yesh, v'yakam v'yelech, v'yivez Esav et ha-bechora. So the pasuk uses the word v'yivez to describe what it was that Esav had just done to the bechora, selling it, giving it away for a bowl of soup. Kind of what a terrible thing this he had done to the Bechorah, scorn. He had treated it with this terrible scorn. And what's interesting here is both elements of disdain, both of Haman and of Esav, mark the beginning of a greater loss that they would bring upon themselves later. Both for Haman, his bizayon, his vayivez, was going to lead him to a great downfall later, and the same for Esav. It was going to cause him to lose something much later. Here you have two rare words that appear in different places that can bring you something. The final one I'll just throw in because I think it's interesting. It's something that is sometimes called an intertextual echo, where it's not really using the same words or the same themes or a rare word, but there's just something about the story that kind of sounds the same. And I think an interesting one there, and just very quickly in source set 5, is the idea that when Avraham and Yitzhak, oh, that would be Bereishit, sorry, not source set 5. I may not have included. Oh, source 7. This is interesting. If you look at the top of the second page, that we find that when Avraham and Yitzchak are going towards the Akedah, it uses the word in Pasuk Chet, Vayelchu Shnehem, that they walked together. So that's not a rare word. It's not a rare phrase. It's just, and they walked together towards the Akedah. So we actually see that word happen again in Megillat Rut, where Rut and Naomi are coming back from Moab, and it says Vatelachna Shtehem, and the Midrash kind of jumps on this and says, well, that sounds very similar, and maybe there are comparisons we can make between what's going on with Avraham and Yitzhak and Rut and Naomi. So sometimes that is referred to as an intertextual echo. There's nothing really there to compare, but it just kind of sounds the same. Okay, so I think we've done a pretty very, very, very brief watered down overview of different ways of looking at comparisons between text, thematic or motifs, similar phrases, rare words, or sometimes things that just kind of sound the same, and then kind of looking at them together, and what can we take? So this kind of happens in different ways. Alter usually focuses on motifs that are not based on language. Chazal very often pick up on similar language, and we'll compare those two. And once you're aware of this, and you start just like reading through Rashi, you'll see this kind of happen a lot. This is really what they're doing. Okay, so what do I want to do today? Now that we have that background, I'd like to do a little bit of an exercise in intertextuality, that is a twist on these classic categories that I've talked about. And what I'd really like to do is look at Rut and Esther together, not for the themes that appear that are complementary or parallel to each other, but for how they speak to a specific theme by using ideas that are actually in negation to each other. That both of them speak to a very specific idea and are actually asking very similar questions about this idea, but they're doing it through imagery and through language that is actually very different from each other. So kind of contrasting or intertextuality and tension with each other, talking in language that is very different, even though it's asking the same question. And that question is made very powerful by looking at the way the two Sfarim ask that question in very different ways. So Let's get started. Okay, so let's start with the obvious ways to kind of understand Root and Esther in parallel with each other and how the two are a unit or may speak to each other. Once you actually start looking at the two together, it's actually fascinating how parallel the two are. So let's say there's some sort of very basic comparisons on the one hand. They're both texts about a female heroine who asserts herself, takes chances, and succeeds in some sort of redemptive reversal of fortune due to kind of a very brazen scheme by the heroine. So basically, just straight from the text itself, there's something here that we can look at the two of them together. They're both in forced residence in an alien land. So if you look at Esther and Root, both are members of a marginalized group. They're foreigners in the place where they are, whether it's Esther in the palace or Root coming from Moab to join the Jewish people. In both books, they don't challenge the system itself, but they work their way out of marginalization by working within the system, right? Esther doesn't overthrow the palace and the kingdom. She finds a way to work within it. Root comes and joins the Jewish people and becomes the ancestor of David HaMelech by joining the system which she's in. Again, I think every statement I make right now could be an entire lecture in and of itself, but I just kind of want to look through some basic parallels between the two books before we focus on their different themes and motifs. Both, which I think is just also interesting, Root and Esther, both end up advancing their position very often in the story, and you can see both of those. I'm not going to look at them right now, but if you read the sources in source set 5, you'll see that they both, there's language where both of them are kind of advancing their position and moving along. Along these lines, neither of them match the classic portrayal story of women or the classic matriarchal story in terms of the way we look at some of our matriarchs in Sefer Bereishit. Neither of them match that story. Again, whole nother sheer. Both of them find themselves in what Chazal really tried to put in work very hard actually to paint in an understandable light. Both of them find themselves in very questionable sexual situations, and you have Chazal really coming to re-explain Paragimel in Root in a way that makes sense, as well as Esther and Ahasuerus. You've got a nice amount in Masechet Megillah that talks about, like, I don't understand what's going on here. She intermarries, she's married to this non-Jew, how do we explain that? So both of them go through experiences like that that the Midrash kind of really rushes to explain. Both go through extensive preparation for that encounter, and that's, I think, almost interesting to look at Esther Perek Bet and Root Perek Gimel in source set six. They both describe how the two of them go through very extensive, almost physical preparation for their encounter, either with Boaz in the field or with Esther and Ahasuerus. And again, interestingly, similar language between the two. So this is just my list of parallels before we go into differences. They both follow a very similar literary genre narrative, which is that of almost the short novella. They're the only books in Nevi'im or Ketuvim to do this. This idea of a short narrative text, which is a short contained story with a beginning, middle, and end. Sketches a tense situation, complicating factors, and then a very positive, happy resolution. So they both kind of follow that short story. It's usually pretty self-contained and far more interested in the characters than in the particular historical event being described. They are also, and we're almost done here, they're both narrative companion texts to historical periods and events going on in other parts of Tanakh. This is true of Eicha as well. So let's say Sefer Bereishit doesn't really have a companion text in Tanakh where it's telling you about other things that are going on. But Esther has Ezra, where you're really getting a sense of, and this was this year, I think I gave a couple years ago here at Midrash at Yom Rishon, looking at the way Ezra is actually kind of a background story of what's going on in other places or other parts of history while the Esther story taking place. And obviously Root has Shoftim. Root is a narrative story that is being set within the historical period of Sefer Shoftim. Root opens with Vayihi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim, and we'll come back to that a little bit later when we talk about Root and Esther again. And finally, just to kind of cap off our list of parallels, they both deal with the idea of divine intervention and Yad Hashem happening in a more natural way. So this is something that we've all heard very often when it comes to Esther. There's no Shem Hashem in the story. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not there, and he's really working through a more natural way in what's going on there. But it's actually, you know, with no overt action. Kadosh Baruch Hu is not a character in the way he is in Torah or in many of the books of the Nevi'im. No overt miracles, no overt action. And actually, and again, this is a whole other discussion, this is a very similar theme in Rut, in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not a character. The only times you see him appear is in the speech of the people involved. So if Rut kind of begins this idea of moving away from direct hashkacha, in that every time you see the Shem Hashem appear, it's because the people are talking about him, but not that he's playing a direct role in talking to them straight through Nevuah. So then Esther really comes and takes that idea, you know, reductio ad absurdum, to this place where it's like, we really need to talk about the idea of natural Yad Hashem, because he doesn't appear at all. So they both speak to that theme in interesting ways. So those are all the similarities between the two. What I want to do today is analyze some of the contrasting images and language, and we'll come back to some of those parallel ideas in order to kind of get us to the ultimate way in which the two speak to a very particular theme. And so let's begin. I want to look at three ways in which the Rut and Esther speak in contrasting ways to each other. The first is the idea that Rut is a pastoral narrative and Esther is a city narrative. So let me explain what I mean by that. What a pastoral narrative, sometimes called the bucolic, is when you have a story that really deals with settings and language of these visions of a kind of simple, rural, country life. A lot of words like field and agriculture and relationship with the land. A pastoral genre usually emphasizes a more natural interaction with the land, with the countryside, a retreat from the life of the courts, of the city, the political, urban, monarchic environments. Usually, very often in literature, you see the idea of the pastoral as an overt social criticism, like the rural harmony of the outdoors in contrast with the corruption of court or city life. So I'll show you one example that is one of my favorites from literature, and then I'm gonna show you how we see that actually a lot in Tanakh, this kind of back and forth between the kedusha, or the purity of the agricultural natural life, and the city often being painted as something negative or corrupt. But if you take a look at source number 8, so Shakespeare does this a lot, As You Like It, The Winter's Tale, where the main setting is a forest or a pastoral setting, and As You Like It's a really very good example because it's about court people seeking refuge from the courts in rural life, where everything is possible, and getting away from the corruption or stagnation of court life. So that's where love can occur, that's where there's endless possibilities, that's where singing and dancing can happen, and you can see the Duke's lines at the beginning when they enter the forest. Now my co-mates and brothers in exile have not old custom made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp? Are not these woods more free from peril than the envious court? Or the way he ends, and this our life, exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in the running brook, sermons in stones, and good in everything. This idea that once you get out of the city and into the beauty of the outdoors and what is real and natural, that's where life can really begin. And what's really interesting is that you see this a lot in Tanakh, this kind of back and forth. So let's say Moshe's move from the corruption of Mitzrayim and what's going on in terms of people telling on each other, getting him killed, the corrupt that's happening in the story with the two Anashim and with Paro wanting to kill him, and then moving away from that into the shepherd life that he moves into, the wells and the shepherds, and moving out into the idea of that better life that can occur when you move from the city to the field. The corruption of Shaul versus, again, David the shepherd. Shaul the king, the monarch, the city man, versus David, the more innocent, righteous king coming from the field. You see this a lot with Eliyahu and Elisha. You see it with Ahav and Kerem Navot. Navot is the one who's right here, who's holding on to his Nahala. The vineyard represents the purity of Navot, and Ahav the king coming out of his palace. You see it right at the beginning of the story, leaving his palace, going to corrupt what it is that is Navot. Migdal Bavel, the first time a city is really built in Tanakh, which is emblematic of corruption and of negativity. Cain also moving from the field to city building, kind of also symbolizing his corruption, according to some Perushim. So again, for Torah, many of its major stories occur in the countryside, in forests or groves or vineyards, rather in the country, rather in the kind of metropolis or urban or urban setting. You know, Mashal HaKerem in Yeshayahu, very often the description of love between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the people is done in very pastoral language, Hashirim, and very often negative descriptions will occur with more city life. So for instance, Migdal Bavel, but also Eicha, when we talk about destruction, negativity, and downfall, we'll use the idea of the destruction of the city, but when it comes to the ideas of love, we'll use the pastoral. So, let's take this back. Rut is very much a pastoral narrative. If you look even, we can look all over, you know, I didn't want to put the entire Megillah here, although I put most of it, but if you look at Megillat Rut, almost so much of the imagery is about Yimei HaKotzrim, what's going on in the fields, the Sadeh, even calling Moav, stay Moav. So if you take a look, let's say, where I put Megillat Rut on the source sheet, let's take a look here. Perek Bet, right? Pasuk Bet. Batoma Rut Namovia El Naami, Achana HaSadeh, El Katabish Belim Achera, Sherem Sachim Be'inav. I'm going to go to the field and I'm going to gather the wheat. And then you see lots of language throughout the Perek on Vayomar HaKotzrim, Hashemim Achem. She's talking to the people in the field. The episode in Perek Gimel takes place in the field. It's very much a pastoral narrative in much of its language. And Esther, obviously, is in much of its language very much a city narrative. It's all about the king and the Dat HaMelech and the laws and the Achashtarpanim and the Srisai HaMelech and edicts and, you know, the satraps and the advisors. It's all taking place in the capital city of Shushan HaBira. It's very much a story taking place within the city walls. So that's contrast number one. Rut is a very much a pastoral narrative. Esther is very much a city or an urban narrative. Hold that in your heads. That's point number one. Point number two, I'm going to try to move us a little bit along here so we can get to kind of the final point. Point number two. Food and sustenance words play a major part in both Sfarim. But again, just like comparison number one, pastoral city, the food in Rut, right, is very much symbolized by the ideas of very basic foods, barley, chitim, amraim, sheaves, grain, etc. Zera, food from the land, very basic food. Lechem, there's three or four different words for lechem in Megillat Rut, kind of very basic food. And the food in Esther is very much of a mishteh, yayin, food that's connected to far more kind of complex carbs, like more extreme, exaggerated type of excess. Type of food, and really kind of contributes to this sense of feasting, eating that is not simple, eating that is very complex, occurs very often throughout Megillat Esther. So again, I think it's a similar contrast to our first contrast in that in Rut you have this kind of more simple agricultural life, they eat simple things, even Boaz, when he comes down to eat with his workers in the field, he's doing so, kind of they're eating, again, patech, it calls pot, kind of very basic food, and of course, Megillat Esther opens with the mishcheh, the yayin, the feast, the excessive intake that's going on. And actually, Adele Berlin, in her introduction to the JPS version of Tanakh, talks a lot about this theme of excess and exaggeration that occurs throughout Megillat Esther, even in numbers. She said, 50 cubits high, 75,000 kikar kesef. The whole language of Megillat Esther is very excessive. It's very flowery language, like, what is your wish? It shall be granted. Like, you're really getting a sense of the pomp of city life, or even the idea that the Megillah never uses, she says, this is very interesting, the Megillah never uses one word when it can use two. So, ish ve'ish, Medina u Medina, like it's a very kind of flowery, court-based kind of language. B'chol Medina u Medina, b'chol ir va'ir, makom asher diber ha-melech v'dato higia. It's kind of, when you read it, I think we all feel this, naturally, it has that kind of very fancy language, and you definitely see that when it comes to the partying and the feasting and the mishcheh and the yayin, which is the type of food going on in Esther versus the more simple food of Rut. So that's number two, connected to number one. Pastoral narrative, city narrative, excessive fancy food versus the more simple food. And notice this when you're reading through Megillat Esther and Megillat Rut, the food words are kind of, are everywhere for both of them. Number three, which I also find to be kind of a very interesting contrast. Again, we're looking at contrast between the two, how they use their language to speak in contrast to each other in the same theme. Number three, the element of dialogue in the narratives is actually very interesting. There is a real paucity of direct speech in Esther. It's very passive construction. You don't often see the characters actually talking to each other, but you more often get told what it is that they're saying. So for instance, take a look here. This is actually kind of also very interesting, and we'll tie back to the other two. So let's say take a look under the source 10, which is Megillat Esther, in which I underlined in Perek Aleph just some of the ways that you see kind of the grandeur of the food theme in Perek Aleph. Hashkot b'klei zahav, drinking out of golden vessels, yayin malchut rav. So I just underlined some of those from Perek Aleph. But if you look at source 11, Esther Perek Bet and Gimel, Lo Perek Bet Pasuk Yod. Lo Igida Esther Et Amav Et Moladeta Ki Mordechai Tziva Ale Asher Lo Tagid. So we get told that Mordechai told her not to tell, but we don't actually get his direct words to Esther to conceal her background. Just the report that he told her this. Same thing in Perek Gimel Pasuk Dalet. Vayikamra Melav Yom Yom Velo Shama Aleim Vayagidu LeHaman Lerota Yamdu Divrei Mordechai Ki Igid LeHem Asher Yehudei. So again, we don't see that people went to Haman and told him, Mordechai won't bat you, but it was told. So there's a lot of kind of passive construction in Esther. It kind of puts a little bit, there are a lot of reasons this occurs kind of literarily, which I don't want to get into. It does put a little bit more of kind of psychological distance between you and the characters. It is more passive. We'll come back to this when we tie the three different contrasts together. But interestingly enough, Rut is chock full of dialogue. It's got more dialogue per pasuk or per perek than almost any other sefer. I think close to 65 of the 85 pasukim in Rut are active dialogue. You're not getting told what is happening. The characters themselves are talking to each other. So again, this kind of contrast between the two. In literature, they call this showing and telling, that when you tell something, that when the author or narrator is telling something to his audience or to his readers, he's just giving you the flat kind of passive way of this is what happened or this is what told. But when you show something to your readers, you don't tell them, you just have the characters speak to each other. So kind of showing and telling, and Rut and Esther are kind of two really contrasting examples of those two things. Okay, so we have our three categories, okay? We have our pastoral narrative, city narrative, we have our excessive food language and our very simple food language, kind of tied to the first one, and then we have this kind of active, passive dialogue. So let's bring this all home to what I think is the theme that both Sfarim are speaking to. And that is as follows. I think both texts are asking, using these differentiating images, are asking a very strong question about the nature of law, the nature of monarchy, and the nature of government. Both of these texts are speaking very strongly about what these ideas mean. So let me kind of walk you through what I mean by that and how they're both speaking to it. One, by presenting the question of what it should look like, and Rut, and Esther, by presenting an image, a mockery of what government looks like when it goes wrong. And let me kind of walk you through a little bit what I mean by that. So first of all, the idea of monarchy in general obviously is appearing very strongly in both books. In Esther, it's all about Ahasuerus, the head of the king, the laws, you know, the way he's governing his kingdom. You're getting geographical locations and numbers. But Rut actually talks a lot about the idea of law and who is in control and who is running things and the idea of government as well. Not in the first three prakim, which are pastoral and are about, you know, not having a need for that type of structure, of power structure, but that being out in the open and the fields is the preferred way of living. But in Perek Dalet, which takes a U-turn and actually talks about the city gates and the structured halachic system going on here and what's happening between Rut and Boav, which is following a very specific system of law. And Rut's the only one of the Megillot that actually deals with the legalities of halacha, that talks about a specific halachic idea that is being incorporated and being utilized in the story. So there's no language of law, rule, edict in the way we have in Achashverosh, but they're definitely talking about that idea. And you have this system in Ru Perek Dalet in which there are witnesses and there's a case going on and you have the Zakenim, and law is being carried out in a way that works and in a way that functions well, even if the first three Prakim don't really give that sort of imagery. But the main way in that Rut deals with the idea of the political and the monarchy is that the closing psukim of Rut are about the birth of David and the Davidic dynasty and the political system that will become part of Eretz Yisrael and Am Yisrael. So here you have this kind of double irony in Rut, in that the first few prakim are very pastoral and very lacking in any sort of monarchical system, but in the end, this is the story that gives birth to the political system. The greater irony that's going on in Rut is that Rut is taking place in the time of the Shoftim, in which there is no Ein Melech B'Yisrael, right? The famous phrase from Sefer Shoftim, in which because there is no political system and no monarchical system, everything's going awry. There's chaos. And you kind of see this if you take a look in, flip over to source 15, Sefer Shoftim, the last pasuk of the Sefer, Bayamim Ahem, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, Ish HaYashar Be'Einav Yaseh. What happens when you don't have a structured political governmental system? Everything goes crazy. Pilagesh Be'Givah, killing out Shevet Binyamin, all the nutty stories that are going on at the end of Sefer Shoftim. So the irony of Rut is that you have a story taking place in this no government, chaotic time period. But Rut itself is the contrast to that in its kind of calm, idyllic, bucolic, pastoral story, that everything's going well, everything's going perfectly, and that in the end, things work out well for Rut using the system of rules and using the system of laws without a king. So Rut is kind of asking this question of, need a king? Don't need a king. Things work out really well for Rut. Things work out really nicely in this kind of more pastoral system, and yet what's going on around her is chaotic. And actually, the Sefer Rut itself seems to be saying, well, maybe we do kind of prefer a king, because Rut's going to become the one who's going to birth the future monarch of Am Yisrael. So it's kind of asking that question and playing with it, both in its language, in its context, in the fact that it's a pastoral narrative, that it's more simple, that it's not a court story, but it introduces the idea of the future court. So, and there's actually kind of, just since we're on the linguistic ideas, there's an interesting linguistic idea that the way it gives the lineage at the end, the introduction to David, is 10 generations, which is almost like legitimizing the birth of David, because it brings you back to the toldot that go on very often in Sefer Bereishit. So just like we have toldot that introduce 10 generations that introduce Noach, hero, 10 generations that introduce Avraham, you know, of Am Yisrael, so we then get that same kind of literary idea of the 10 generations introducing David. So it's legitimizing and making positive the introduction of the king in a story where things work out nicely without the rule of king. So it's kind of like asking that question and playing with it. And then you get to Megillat Esther, in which there's a very strong critique of monarchy by the fact that Ahasuerus is, in many ways, a joke of a king. No control over his own kingdom, never makes a decision by himself, by the way. It's always by the advice of some sort of group of advisors. One of the best descriptions I found of this is Yoram Hazoni, in his book The Dawn, a political philosopher from Israel and the founder of Shalem College, has a book where he talks a lot about the politics, the political philosophy in Megillat Esther. So if you look at source 12, he says, he talks about Ahasuerus as a political ruler. All spirit, he will do anything to feel that he has control over others. Having no reason of his own to speak of, he has no idea what to do with this rule. Indeed, Ahasuerus never makes a decision of substance on his own in the entire book of Esther. He knows that he may demonstrate his power by issuing commands and having them obeyed, wants his subjects to fear him and do his bidding. Calling Vashti and to just do what he wants her to do. No reason, you know, no logical reason behind that law. This, I thought, was an interesting point, too, that he makes. Ahasuerus is the ruler of most of civilization, from Ethiopia to India, and one might think that his time would be taken up with the responsibilities of governing more than 100 provinces or of securing them against external threats. Nevertheless, Esther begins by informing us that by the third year of his reign, the principal concern to which he dedicates himself is an ongoing carnival of drinking, which occupies the attention of the political, military, and administrative elite of the empire for no less than 6 months. There are some Pirushim that actually say that the reason he was throwing these parties were political, to kind of meet everyone in his empire and get to know them, but the imagery of Perek Aleph really just seems like a whole lot of fun and partying and revelry. So root is almost like what a law system, especially in Perek Daled, can look like when it goes right, when it's not necessarily taking place in a formal hall with a fancy king and a scepter and beautiful zahav and kesef and tcheled and argaman, and without those descriptions, root is a poor foreigner, but the law is carried out well with them without the trappings and accoutrements of a fancy government. In fact, in root will be the beginning or the ancestor of the person who pulls the people out of chaos and into a positive, normal, solid, real political reign. Esther is v'nahapochu. Esther is about a country and a government and a rulership that rules by whim. Anyone who tells him what he thinks he wants to hear, or, you know, a beautiful woman who kind of works her way to tell him something, he goes with it, kind of following his own whim and his own spirit. And they become intention analogies to each other, asking the question of what should government look like and what should rulership look like. The timing of both is also fascinating, because Rut and Esther actually form an inclusio in Tanakh, in that Rut is really the beginning of the political rule of Am Yisrael, right? She gives birth to David, and Esther takes place at the end, right after the Churban, or at least a few generations after the Churban, when our own political and monarchical system went bad and went wrong, where the kings started seeing themselves as having a degree of power that they could abuse. All you have to do is look at the stories of Jehoiakim and Tzidkiyahu and the way they thought about their rule, most especially Tzidkiyahu, the last king, who can't, you know, act on his own at all, and everything is about what the people are going to think of me, or what my advisors are going to do, or how I can stay in power. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, but interestingly enough, it's almost like Esther, as a mockery of a political system, is also speaking to us, because it's saying, look what happened even to the great and beautiful and amazing Davidic dynasty when kings started to think in the wrong way or look the wrong way. And this is a question, the question the two are asking in their opposing imagery, and let's kind of run through those three. Pastoral city, right? Root as the pastoral, kind of looking at this ideal of getting away from the corruption of the city. We don't want the corruption of the city. And yet at the end saying, but we do need some sort of government. It's like the Megillah itself is struggling with that question. And Esther as a pure city, pure corruption, Tanakh imagery in which the city is not a good place to be and is not a positive governmental system. The way they talk about food, right? The idea of excess in Esther versus Ruth, where it's like, maybe this idea of kind of piling on the wealth and the opulence and having everything you need, i.e. a king should not have too much zahav v'kesev and too much excess. And there are even ways of looking at the way Shlomo HaMelech's kingdom is described in Malachim Aleph as also very excessive food imagery, what was on his table and what they were eating, as a symbol of something the king shouldn't have or really shouldn't do. And finally, I think it's also interesting in that root is a lot of people talking to each other, right? Communication and acting in a way in which what the other person thinks matters. Root listening to the advice of Naomi, having a conversation with Boaz, versus just this kind of fancy, and it was told, lack of communication. The characters kind of not really being active people who are thinking and who are feeling, but just people who are kind of carrying out certain requirements of that role that they're in, or that political role that they're in. So when you look at that, though, all of those in contrast, the two are really asking that question together, but asking it in very different ways. And this is a question that the Nevi'im deal with a lot. What should power look like? We need a king. We need a government. We need a structure. What should it look like? Political philosophers have discussed this as well. You know, what should a king look like? The founding of this country, Thomas Paine and Common Sense. Do we need a king? Do we not? Wait, we definitely need a king. How can we not have a king? Thomas Paine comes in with Common Sense and says, no way a governmental system should need a king. And this is kind of a question that once you start looking anywhere, there anything that speaks about politics and the king, that question is really, really everywhere. And the two, I think, Ruth and Esther together, are asking that question. And what's interesting is that Ruth and Esther are both women who flout convention. They're both women who kind of go beyond what we think are the normative rules or the normative roles of women. Ruth doing something that's obviously crossing a boundary, coming from a different place, and the whole question that the Midrash deals with about, you know, Moavi below Moavi, that she can join that she's not really breaking a law, even though it might seem like it. Ruth as someone who flouts convention, Esther obviously also, a little bit different. The question of her in Achashverosh's palace, where is she at the end of the story? She's not building a nice Jewish home. So here are both women who are crossing what we see as normative rules, and yet both of their books are asking the question of what should a rule system look like? When are the times that things should be crossed and they should be broken? When, what is a king supposed to look like, a good king supposed to look like, etc.? And that's something that I think that is definitely asking as you move from the pastoral to the city gates. So Ruth's name herself, by the way, and this was pointed out in a share I heard from Aviva Zornberg, her name itself actually points to this idea, Ruth from Rivehu or Hirva, which means to saturate or to drench, the idea of to infiltrate, to flow everywhere, no boundaries, open the field, we don't need rules, we don't need a law system, things can work out well without it. Her name seems to be hinting at that, which is just interesting because I think her sefer is really asking that question of the way the rules do work well, or the way that Esther asked, the way what happens when rules are compromised, or when rules are used just for the whim of the king. One last piece I want to look at to kind of take this home. By the way, this is a theme that you kind of see all over. The idea of Har Sinai, that Torah was given in a desert, right? That it was specifically given in a place with no boundaries, kind of open thought and no rules, and yet all of the story of Har Sinai itself is about gvulot, it's about boundaries. Don't come too close, make sure you maintain a distance. Again, that tension of working with a system that has to work, but then also not being so bound to a system that we don't know when we have to, let's say like with Ruth and Naomi, work a little bit around it without actually breaking the law. What should law look like? That question, that's really kind of being asked. Or the idea that Hashem didn't want Torah bound just to Eretz Yisrael, that he gave it in Eretz Yisrael. People would think that the laws were only bound to Eretz Yisrael. He specifically wanted to give it in the wilderness so that it would, you know, we would understand that rules and laws can apply throughout time or throughout geography, not being so bound into a specific time and place, more openness. Again, that theme, kind of going back and forth. So the last interesting piece that I really just wanted to look at is Joshua Berman's piece in Source 13, which I think speaks to this as well, and I just thought was an interesting add-on to this dichotomy. He's a professor of Tanakh at Bar-Ilan, and recently, not so recently anymore, wrote a book called Created Equal, How the Bible Broke with Ancient Political Thought, talking about how Tanakh actually changes the way we look at politics from what was going on in the ancient Near East or the period of the Dor HaMidbar. And I thought this was like so interesting, especially because I'm a big Navi person. I like to really, like, my favorite thing to talk about is like, the Nevi'im themselves, the essence of Nevuah, what is Navi? I think I did one of those here a couple of years back. And so much of the theme of Navi is this idea of what a melech should look like and what he should not. And a huge fear of the Nevi'im is this idea of deification of the king, of turning the king into a god, of seeing the king as the source of control and the source of power rather than a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And Berman says, very interestingly, that the shift that you see occur in Ketuvim and in the Megillah is a move away from the fear, and here he says it, if much of biblical writing reveals an ambivalent attitude towards the notion of monarchy, I would suggest it's not because of a fear of the Almighty being marginalized, but those texts reflect a fear that a strong monarchy would result in the marginalizing of the common man, that we move from a period in which it's not that we're afraid that the king will take the place of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, it's that we're afraid that the king who goes wrong is actually going to marginalize the common man. That it's the weak person, it's the foreigner, it's the marginalized person, the Jew, who will be on the receiving end of the negative edicts or the power of the king gone awry. And that's another fascinating piece that appears in both Ruth and Esther, right? What's going on in Ruth is that when the law works right, you can have a widow and a foreigner who are welcomed into the community. Achashverosh is that when the law doesn't work right, it's the common man who's on the receiving end of it. And I think you see that shift in Navi a lot, that in the beginning we're worried about the fear of forgetting a Kadosh Baruch Hu. When we get to the end of like Jehoiakim and Sidkiyahu, Jehoiakim is criticized for spilling dam naki in the streets of Yerushalayim, having a court system that was marginalizing the poor. This idea that when politics work right, it's the common man who is incorporated. So much of Tanakh is concerned with the idea of the atom, the ger, the almana, make sure we set up a political system where the weak people on the bottom are not marginalized. And I think Ruth and Esther, again, in contrasting ways, both speak to that idea, which I also thought was kind of a significant add-on to this. So in summary, here we have a really interesting exercise in intertextuality between these two Sfarim. So many things that they have in common, and yet by speaking in contrasting ways about the narratives themselves, they're both asking the same question, but utilizing it in slightly different form in the way that they present it. All I would end with is saying is that I once heard a really beautiful line attributed to Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, where he said that the non-Jews tell their children stories to put them to sleep, but we tell our children stories to wake them up. And I think that there's no better way of looking at Ruth and Esther, because they're in that short narrative type of way. They're the stories that every kid grows up knowing what Megillat Esther is about, and every little girl definitely knows all about Esther. Esther and Ruth, I think that there's no better way to look at the stories of these two women as a wake-up call to ask the questions of what it is that governance and rule should look like, and how the ruler and the ideal leader in any location or any place should be interacting and thinking about the people who are under his rule. Have a Chag Purim Sameach and a wonderful day.